From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There have been six movie versions of F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. Six. The most recent one, the Baz Luhrmann version, is getting really good reviews, but before that, none of them were really any good. Not the one in 1926, which was a silent movie. The Fitzgeralds saw that one and walked out. The Robert Redford version didn't really work either. And the Fitzgerald scholar Kirk Kernet says, it's tough to know whether you explore a novel like Gatsby in the context of its time, or you make it relevant to the present. Luhrmann seems to have seen plenty in a novel written in the 20s that would work in 2013. Today in the program, we're talking about The Great Gatsby as a movie, but also as a book, of course, and a reflection of Fitzgerald's life and his view of how the world works. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. And I confess we're talking about it because there's a new movie adaptation of the story. Baz Luhrmann's film is getting good reviews, good audience numbers, which is kind of remarkable when you think about the track record of Gatsby movies. There have been six versions, and before this one, none of them were really noteworthy, not the 1926 silent movie version. The Fitzgerald saw that one, by the way, and walked out of the theater. Zelda said it was rotten and awful and terrible. The literary scholar Kirk Kernet says that he seems to sympathize with filmmakers who are trying to tackle a classic like Gatsby. Directors have to decide if they're going to do a period piece or if you make the themes relevant to today, to the present. Luhrmann set the film in the roaring 20s, of course, but the ideas, the music, all of that seemed to be contemporary in some way. Kernet says the visuals of the film appeal to young people right now who are being told that their economic prospects are pretty grim, so the opulence of that time seems kind of fantasy. Today in the program, we're talking about The Great Gatsby, not just as a movie, of course, not so much as a movie, more as a book, really, a classic American novel. We hope to hear from you if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Kirk Kernet is a professor of English at Troy University, Montgomery, there in Alabama. Serves as vice president for the International F. Scott Fitzgerald Society. Is managing editor for the academic journal The F. Scott Fitzgerald Review. And he's joining us today from public radio station WVAS in Montgomery. Kirk Kernet, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I wanted to start with you've written that you think that F. Scott Fitzgerald is undergoing a kind of critical makeover right now. And the writers of his stature, you say, often go through this kind of process, this kind of makeover. Talk a little bit about that at first. How are we thinking about or making over F. Scott Fitzgerald today?
Well, I think as you say, all of these great writers kind of go through periods where they are reinvented for the times in which they're being reinvented. You really have to kind of look at the overall arc of time of Fitzgerald's critical reception. You know, he was really largely forgotten at the time of his death. And yeah. Then we went through a period in the 40s and 50s where there was a sort of concerted effort to convince the establishment that he was indeed great. Mm. Then we go through a long period where we have to, confirm over and over again what's in the works that makes him so great. But now I think we're really in a period where we're able to use him to go back into the 20s and kind of crack open that crazy decade and figure things out. So there's been a long effort to move him out of history, to make him timeless so he doesn't seem so frivolous. But now I think we're ready to put him back into the Jazz Age to understand it better.
There's this piece that you've referred to. It's getting some attention. It's written by a woman named Catherine Schultz, and she writes for The Vulture. And she's writing about how she knows she's supposed to feel a certain way about The Great Gatsby, you know, how she's supposed to regard it as, you know, one of the great American novels. But it just seems like she doesn't get it. I mean, she says it's overrated. She says it's, here's how she puts it, psychologically vacant, morally complacent. And she seems like she just hates this idea that it's kind of sacrosanct, that it's like an English assignment.
Yeah.
What do you make of that kind of response?
Well, I've been telling friends for 3 or 4 months now to get ready for the backlash because there's been, you know, with all the hype around the movie, and then there are 4 novels about Zelda coming out this year.
Yeah.
I said, inevitably, we're going to go through a period, and I was sort of aiming for June, where there would be voices coming out and saying, listen, he's not all that great, the novel's not all that great, this is too much. So I think it's natural. I think it's a healthy argument to have. I was not offended by her piece. I chuckled a couple times in it when she mentioned that to her the greatest one of the greatest novels ever written was Middlemarch by George Eliot, which, you know, it's taster's choice when it comes when it comes to books, you know. But I think that you know, some of the issues that she addresses, I think, you know, they are valid and they are good opportunities for folks like me who, you know, have enjoyed the Kool-Aid for a long time to really understand how we need to reach out and to convince readers that it's not psychologically or morally vacant. So I think it's a good piece to have, and of course I don't agree with a word of it.
I wanted to ask about your own personal connection to Fitzgerald, because it's interesting. You talk about how your earliest memory, if I get this right anyway, your mother reading a book about Zelda Fitzgerald?
Well, when I was a child, my mother, who was not a literary person at all, but she was a prodigious reader, we had a stack of her books in the basement. And interestingly enough, most of those were the sort of 70s kind of racy things that people were discovering at the time, you know, things like, you know, Erica Jong or Gay Talese.
Yeah.
And but I do have vivid memories of Zelda being one of those books. And I can remember flipping through the pictures and being very disturbed by one particular picture of her shortly before her breakdown in 1930. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really didn't think anything else about it until I was in high school and began reading some of the early short stories, kind of made my way through Fitzgerald there. But then when I got to college, I discovered that really the cool, funky girls at college were all had this book called Zelda by Nancy Milford.
Yeah.
And it really became a way of kind of creating a literary identity at college. You know, other kids were into the Beats. Other kids were into, you know, whatever was postmodern at the time. I knew several guys who were kind of Raymond Carver type characters, and how much fun would that be? But, you know, I just enjoyed the ability to be the Fitzgerald guy. And, you know, I fell out of it after undergraduate school, because in graduate school, he really wasn't fashionable.
Huh. But you talk about how your interest really deepened when you moved to Montgomery.
Yeah, I just happened to get a job in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the town where Zelda Sayre was born and where they met in 1918. And, you know, to me, the minute I sort of drove into town and realized how much history was here, it seemed like fate or kismet. So it's been a nice career ever since then, 20 years now.
Hmm. Do you get a sense that we'll talk about the Midwest. We'll talk about this idea of Westerners who you know, people, the Great Gatsby as characters. But do you get any sense from the South in Fitzgerald's writing?
Oh, definitely, because Zelda being from here, he was very much attracted to Southern women and very much interested in the connection to the history. His father was actually considered a Southerner. His father had, you know, as a child, had actually worked as a sort of child message runner for the Confederate Army. And so he identified with that lost tradition of the South, and wrote 3 or 4 stories set in the South. It's not at all unusual. You know, we don't think in the Deep South of Louisville, Kentucky as the South, but Daisy Fay is, in a sense, a Southerner more than a Midwesterner. So there is a lot of South in his writing.
There's a quote you use in one of your books where Fitzgerald admits that he says this: "The history of my life is the history of the struggle between an overwhelming urge to write and a combination of circumstances bent on keeping me from it." What did you to ask about that? Because you sure. say that really understanding his writing requires less emphasis on the how circumstance, you know, interfered with his art, and more on how they compelled it. Let's right. talk about that.
Well, I think first off, when people hear that quote, the first thing they think of is alcohol.
Yeah.
And you know, and we are dealing with an alcoholic here, and you know, I think Fitzgerald felt he was a failure in terms of his productivity later in life because he did only produce four novels and one unfinished one.
Right.
And the novel was the sort of the marquee genre at the time. I don't think he was unprolific. I mean, the guy over the course of 20 years wrote more than 100 short stories, and you know, 65 of them went to the Saturday Evening Post, which was the premier outlet at the time. And, you know, he made in what today's money would be almost $3 million off the short story. The problem was the short story was kind of considered, you know, being a commercial genre
yeah.
at the time, which, of course, it's not it's not now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was really considered an environment for hacks. And I think he was very sensitive about that. As far as the personal circumstances that get in the way of writing, you know, beyond the alcoholism, we think, of course, of Zelda's mental illness in
right.
the 30s, which put an incredible financial burden on him to take care of her. So I think his struggle, you know, it's easy to view his career and say, well, if only he hadn't had those problems, he could have written so much more. Mm-hmm. But really, he wrote a lot more short stories than Hemingway did. I think my sort of take on that is we have to understand that his struggle was so much of his work was biographical.
Yeah.
And he needed that stimulus of personal experience in order to have stories to write about. So it's almost like you have to think of it as a kind of work shift. You have to live a couple days in order to have one day to write, because otherwise you don't have anything to write about.
Yeah. You know, I keep, we're sort of working our way to The Great Gatsby as a, you know, the plot of it. And I keep going back and reading about his early life,
mm-hmm.
his relationship with Zelda. You know, she spurned him for a time. She
sure.
was suspicious of whether or not he could, you know, make a living. You know, again, this concept of a rich girl or rich girls more broadly rejecting poor boys with aspirations is a theme, of course, in The Great Gatsby.
Right.
And so I'm seeing more and more of F. Scott Fitzgerald as I read some of the things you've been writing in The Great Gatsby. I mean,
yeah, it's definitely there.
Yeah.
And it's not just with Zelda. You know, his first sort of serious romance in his, you know, early 20s was with a woman much wealthier than Zelda's family. Zelda's family was not wealthy. They were prestigious here
right.
in Montgomery, but they weren't rich by any means. But he courted a woman from Illinois named Ginevra King, mm. whose family was very, very wealthy. And then there's the legendary story of how one summer he was visiting their estate and he overheard, whether it was her father, or her uncle, or somebody, say rich boys shouldn't marry, or poor boys shouldn't marry rich girls.
Right.
And, you know, that's actually, they took that line and put it in The New Gatsby. I sort of chuckled when that showed up. So that is a stigma. And he was always keenly aware of that rejection of class, that he was never quite good enough to be accepted by the bright, shining people. And I think that's why you get this profound ambivalence toward class in his work, the desire to be part of the hoi polloi, the rich, and yet at the same time, the willingness to see that, or the impulse to see them as morally corrupt and decadent.
Did he ever identify himself with Gatsby?
I think there's a lot of Gatsby in Fitzgerald. I think the whole notion of self-making, I think the you know, the desire to prove oneself worthy of one's own dreams. All of that is very, very much sympathetic to Fitzgerald. I don't know that he ever came out and said, you know, Jay Gatsby, c'est moi,
yeah.
like Flaubert did. He definitely knew he was tapping into himself when he wrote that character.
I can't tell if I like him all that much sometimes, Scott Fitzgerald.
Fitzgerald?
Yeah, Fitzgerald, in the sense that, like, you write about this, you know, one of these first circumstances he has to overcome to be a writer is his family.
Yeah.
Which raises the question, you know, what did he think of his family? I mean, he was pretty dismissive about his father, for example.
Yeah. Well, his father was an economic failure, yeah. And I think Fitzgerald shouldered that stigma. His mother came from, you know, modest money, but I think, like a lot of men in that generation, they just simply did not understand their parents. This was the World War I generation, and
yeah.
There had been this huge decisive break, and you had these Victorian mothers that were so, you know, you young kids, you know, if you kiss before marriage, you're going to hell. And, you know, they just did not relate to that at all. So I think they're, you know, I do think in an age in which we have learned post-1960s the importance of valuing family and of valuing family connections, that does seem odd. I'll tell you what makes them incredibly hard to teach, especially at a university where we are 51% African American and 50, you know, nearly 70% working class, is people have a hard time getting on into all the sort of country club aspiration.
Yeah.
I think there's much more of a desire on the day of, on the part of everyday Joes to mock that world of the rich, to see it as sort of frivolous or silly, as pointless.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find that that's really the biggest resistance to teaching him, is to say to people, you can get past all of this private school, fancy clothes, Rolls Royce kind of, you know, things, but recognize that a lot of the themes can be relevant to you if you give them a chance.
I think that was one of the things I liked about the idea that Baz Luhrmann was using Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm.
Music,
sure.
In that film as a way of relating that, okay, so maybe you can't relate this particular generation,
right,
to this, as you said, country club aspiration, but you can relate to this question of money and class. It's different. It reflects itself different in the 21st century, but it's still there.
Yeah, I think we as Americans lie to ourselves so much about our desire for money and our feelings about class, or at least the voices that come out to express these things. You know, one of the greatest, I think, contributions that hip-hop and rap made to us was to celebrate or to accept the fact that we are a consumer culture,
right,
that a large part of our sense of identity is driven by consumerism. So I think Luhrmann was very canny in bringing that style of music that is about, you know, it is about being the original gangster. Into it. I think if he didn't, it would have seemed so much more of a museum piece, even if he had used 20s music. The 74 Gatsby has Ain't We Got Fun, which is mentioned in the novel.
Yeah.
But it just seems dreary and old and, you know, like something off your great-grandma's Victrola.
I wonder if this is also part of the problem with your students, is that they're not discovering Fitzgerald for themselves. They're being assigned, you know, this book by you or before in an English class in high school. I mean, this idea that there's something forced about that, and it's an expectation it can't really live up to. It would be nice to be able to let them somehow find it for themselves and then see how they relate.
Sure,
to it.
And I think that's the great thing about the movie is, you know, I've been on Tumblr, which no man at 48 years old needs to be on, to be perfectly honest, but I do enjoy getting on there and sort of looking at what people are saying about Gatsby. And you know, it is refreshing to see a lot of people say, I hated this book in high school, but I like this movie and I want to go back and read it again. I think what happened in high school, and this was my experience with literature, and it's not to knock all of our great high school English teachers. They were products of their time. But, you know, my experience was we were taught literature was about three things. It's about man versus nature, man versus man, man versus himself. And everything was a symbol. And so much of our reading became a sort of hunt and peck for these symbols that were going to tell us what the meaning is. And at some point, I think that just got a little rote and tedious. I didn't necessarily enjoy reading when I was in high school. I began to identify with it in my personal life, but I didn't really find the reading of it in a college classroom and compelling until I had professors that sort of knew how to, you know, how to relate it to me and how to teach me how to get beyond my own personal prejudices or barriers, but how to bring a book alive and how to have fun studying it.
Kirk Kernet is with us. He's managing editor of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Review. He teaches English at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about The Great Gatsby. A lot of us came to the novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald because we had to. It was an assignment in high school or college. The scholar Kirk Kernet says, along with the new film of Gatsby, there's become a new debate about how reverent we need to be with an old classic. Kirk Kernet is joining us today. He's a professor of English at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama, and serves as vice president for the International F. Scott Fitzgerald Society's managing editor for the academic journal, the F. Scott Fitzgerald Review. And you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Well, before we actually get to The Great Gatsby, let's just mention that there were other books before. This Side of Paradise was his first. And I guess this is the book that kind of gives him that reputation, whether it works completely or not, but as the one who would, you know, be the chronicler of the jazz age.
Right. Well, you know, the interesting thing we tend to overlook now is that This Side of Paradise, his first novel, comes out when he's 23 years old, is his biggest success during his lifetime. And if you go back and you look at his obituaries 20 years later, people aren't remembering him for The Great Gatsby. They're remembering him for having created this fad through This Side of Paradise and his early Saturday evening post stories, this sort of vogue for the jazz age and the younger generation and flappers, of course. So, you know, This Side of Paradise is a pretty typical first novel for somebody who's 23. In other words, it's not that good.
Right.
But it has its charms and it has its virtues, and you know, you can really, I think you can enjoy it. I just got done teaching it in a class on youth culture fiction, talking about how books become sort of generational totems, and students really liked it. I'll be honest, I'm much more of probably an advocate for his early short stories, and we just did a project with the Saturday Evening Post and some folks who are licensing their stuff that's in public domain, a book called Gatsby Girls, which collects the first 8 stories he did. And I love those stories to death. They are romance stories that men can get into, if I can put it that way. You know, they're jazzy. There's a lot of stylistic fun. They've got that classic sort of repartee between men and women that is you know, kind of slinky or, you know, kind of sexy. And the plots are just sort of over the top. You know, seduction stories, and you get a sense almost of young readers opening the Saturday Evening Post at this time and discovering Fitzgerald and just feeling like a light is flipping on. There's a lot of joy and a lot of color, and they just feel very alive.
It seems like his writing really evolved. I mean, there's This Side of Paradise, of course, and then The Beautiful and the Damned. And then comes The Great Gatsby. And you've described his earlier work as, you know, less focused, maybe. Sprawling, sure. I think, is the word that you used. Mm-hmm. Whereas it seems like when he comes to The Great Gatsby, it's pretty well focused, tight, taut, in fact, is the word you use there as well.
Well, he got a lot of criticism in those early first two novels about how technique-wise he was too loose, too ramshackle, and he had a bad habit of kind of coming into the story himself and interrupting it and providing all kinds of maxims and aphorisms and sort of moralizing a lot. And I think he understood that by the time he started writing Gatsby, you know, when he was 20, 24, when he really got down to do it at 27 years old, that it was time for his craft to advance. And, you know, there's a great letter he wrote about how he wanted it to be intricately patterned. And I think that's really his focus. He kind of learned how to, sort of focus a lot of his energies into the novel as opposed to expressing the writing of it.
I want to play an excerpt to give people a sense of this writing because it's something you really appreciate. I mean, you say that with this book, you have this, with Gatsby, that is, you have the sense of a writer trying to take his craft to the heights of beauty.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This kind of beautiful writing. And there's a moment in the book, you can set this up for it, when Nick, you know, the narrator, of course, is outside of this party at Gatsby's house, and he follows these curious sounds inside the mansion, and there's this chorus girl singing, and it's just a lovely moment that just kind of hangs there. And
sure.
Maybe you could talk about that, and we could play an excerpt from the book.
Well, it's one of my favorite passages in the book because it's just such a beautiful sort of imagistic moment. And, you know, you're at this party and there's all this revelry going on, and then it's coming to the end of the party and everybody knows that they need to leave, and they're sort of drifting off into the, you know, what we politely today would call passing out.
Right.
And there's this desire for the party not to end. So you've got this chorus girl. And I think for me, it's just that notion of having such a good time, it makes you cry. That's what I love about it.
Yeah. Here's an excerpt then from The Great Gatsby. This is read by the actor Jake Gyllenhaal.
The large room was full of people. One of the girls in yellow was playing the piano, and beside her stood a tall, red-haired young lady from a famous chorus, engaged in song. She had drunk a quantity of champagne, and during the course of her song, she had decided, ineptly, that everything was very, very sad. She was not only singing, she was weeping, too. Whenever there was a pause in the song, she filled it with gasping, broken sobs, and then took up the lyric again, in a quavering soprano. The tears coursed down her cheeks. Not freely, however, for when they came into contact with her heavily beaded eyelashes, they assumed an inky color and pursued the rest of their way in slow black rivulets. A humorous suggestion was made that she sing the notes on her face, whereupon she threw up her hands, sank into a chair, and went off into a deep, vinous sleep.
Deep, vinous sleep. Yeah, so she's just sitting there. I mean, this image of this revelry going on, and she's there, and it's just this kind of beautiful, poignant moment.
Yeah. It's in the movie, except they don't have her cry. That was my major disappointment. I was so ready for that mascara to run down, and I could see notes and staves coming off at me in 3D. And, you know, I was really ready for that. I wanted to bathe in that tear, but didn't happen.
I find it interesting that there's this piece in The Guardian that I read about the Baz Luhrmann film, and I'm not sure how much of this is true, but apparently Francis Ford Coppola had advised Luhrmann that if he was going to come up with something that would be relevant today, to look at the earlier versions of this book, if he wanted to get a sense of that relationship between Jay Gatsby and Daisy, for example, which I want to spend some more time with. But just the earlier versions, when does this idea first occur to F. Scott Fitzgerald?
Well, he's writing this same basic story of the rich girl rejecting the poor boy. That's in This Side of Paradise.
Right.
I think what Coppola is probably referring to are some of the early some of the stories from 1922 to 1924 that are called the Gatsby Cluster, because
right.
they all sort of look forward to the writing, the retelling of this story. There's a famous one called Winter Dreams
right.
that you know, that I think is packed full of a lot of emotion, and one called The Sensible Thing, about a couple trying to decide whether they should get married or not. I think those are that's what Coppola is talking about, and I think what they see in there again is a little bit looser sort of approach with the writing that maybe would give Lerman the feeling that he didn't have to be so I don't know, orthodox mm-hmm. with Gatsby. You know, it's not a holy text. I mean, it should be adapted. It should be altered. It should be changed. I'm not saying do what they did in the 90s when they remade The Scarlet Letter and give it a happy ending.
Right.
That might be taking it too far. But, you know, I think it should be moldable for our own purposes.
It goes to this character of, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it properly, but Trimalchio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a character from Satyricon. It's the character is this freed slave who
right.
goes about attaining wealth and power, and it's a story that really resonated with F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Sure. Well, in fact, that was the original title of the novel was Trimalchio at West Egg or East Egg. I can't remember, but it was one of those two. And you know, the idea was that it was almost like the wasteland, like this ancient legend or ancient story was going to be the sort of the analog, like James Joyce did with the myth of Ulysses. Mm-hmm. And it's in there. I think Lerman actually corresponded when he was making the movie with a colleague of mine who's the current dean of Fitzgerald Studies, a great guy named James L.W. West III at Pennsylvania State University. And Professor West put out that first draft of Gatsby called Trimalchio, which is not all that different from the published text, but Gatsby is a little more self-revealing in there. He talks a little bit more about himself, and I think Fitzgerald saw that as giving away some of the mystery to the character, some of the ambiguity. So maybe that's what Coppola was talking about too.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about this relationship between Jay Gatsby and Daisy Buchanan. Because this question comes up, you see it from time to time, whether or not, in fact, this is really a love story between two fully formed characters.
Mm-hmm.
Or something more abstract, you know, yes, that's the basic structure of it, but that it's less about that particular love story as it is about his own love of his self-image.
Right.
I suppose. And I want to work through Daisy to some degree, but what do you make about that idea?
Well, I think it is true. It's kind of a critical commonplace this day and age to say Gatsby's not a love story. And a lot of the reviewers, this is where they're bashing Lerman a lot, because he has made it sort of a melodrama. And he cites Gone with the Wind as sort of his, you know, ideal of what a love story should be. So I think that for the movie, it has to work that way, because I think that's what the general audience wants.
Right.
think the notion that you're talking about where, you know, Daisy is really the reward or the vindication of Gatsby's attempt at self-making is probably too abstract for a movie. It's too hard to explain. It may belong in a book because it's something that we have to sit down and sort of, you know, hash through before we can really appreciate the implications of that. So it is there. I think part of the beauty of the book is, you know, people do choose to read it as a love story. And personally, I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah. Daisy, there's this revelation in Chapter 7 when Gatsby confronts her husband, Tom. And Daisy is essentially asked to kind of choose between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And Fitzgerald has, I've read things where he's kind of confessed that he wasn't quite sure how Daisy should respond, or if he got it right, her kind of reaction. And he wrote this. He said, "I gave no account and had no feelings or knowledge of the emotional relations between Gatsby and Daisy."
Yeah.
That seems revealing to me about the fact that in some way she's not fully formed, but I don't know. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. I think when the book was a relative failure in 1925 and only sold about 23,000 copies, or about half of what his previous two novels did, that he wrote that was really the failure. Is he didn't see it from the woman's perspective, yeah. And women were the bulk of the readers then as now, and I think that he was recognizing maybe that his own approach to writing his own story about the poor boy trying to win over the rich girl didn't give the rich girl a whole lot to do in the story. What's interesting is a lot of those Saturday Evening Post stories are amazingly empathetic toward women, and I think really capture or express what for a male writer is tapping into your feminine side and being able to understand the dilemmas of women. I think Daisy as a character has always gotten short shrift. I think Carey Mulligan is wonderful as her in the movie. I think she captures the sort of wan uselessness of a rich woman where she has nothing to do. I mean, she was raised to sit on a couch and yawn,
yeah,
and be sort of this object of adoration. And so at this decisive moment in a hotel room when two men are telling her, choose, right, that's not the game for her. She's supposed to be the reward. And there's just too much agency or action that she's supposed to exhibit at that moment. The difficulty is, I think at this stage of the game, that's really not an image of women that people want to see. You know, we want the woman from the Hunger Games. We want the woman as the action hero.
Right.
We want the girl with the tattoo, dragon tattoo, who, you know, isn't inactive. And there just weren't a lot of those images around in the 1920s. So I think we have to, the book makes us work to understand Daisy's dilemma. And for a lot of years, critics just wrote her off as, I won't say the word on radio, but the famous sort of description of her from Leslie Fiedler was, yeah, she was a B, yeah, blank goddess.
Yeah.
And, imagine trying to use that phrase in a classroom in this day and age, and how well that would go over with women in the class. You just can't do it,
yeah,
and you shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And the bigger challenge is to make us understand why Daisy is the way that she is.
There's another excerpt from the book. I want to play another section here. This is at this dinner with Tom Buchanan and Daisy, of course, her husband, and Nick is trying to talk to Daisy, and he talks to her about her daughter. Set this up for us. We play a little excerpt of this.
Well, this is the early scene in the book where Nick Carraway sort of arrives the first time, and he's walking into this opulent East Egg mansion, and that there's, you know, curtains flapping everywhere, and the ceiling is described as a frosted wedding cake, and they are in the process of talking, and Nick becomes very aware that Daisy has a facade, that she's performing in a lot of ways. And then we get this wonderful passage where she's trying to talk about her daughter. And I think it captures sort of the uselessness to which women were raised.
"Listen, Nick, let me tell you what I said when she was born. Would you like to hear?" "Very much. It'll show you how I've gotten to feel about things. Well, she was less than an hour old, and Tom was God knows where. I woke up out of the ether with an utterly abandoned feeling and asked the nurse right away if it was a boy or a girl. She told me it was a girl, and so I turned my head away and wept. "All right," I said. "I'm glad it's a girl. And I hope she'll be a fool. That's the best thing a girl can be in this world. A beautiful little fool. You see, I think everything's terrible anyhow," she went on in a convinced way. "Everybody thinks so. The most advanced people. And I know. I've been everywhere and seen everything and done everything." Her eyes flashed around her in a defiant way, rather like Tom's, and she laughed with a thrilling scorn. "Sophisticated. God, I'm sophisticated." The instant her voice broke off, ceasing to compel my attention, my belief, I felt the basic insincerity of what she had said.
There's an excerpt from The Great Gatsby, read by the actor Jake Gyllenhaal. Kirk Kernet is with us. He's managing editor of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Review, teaches English at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama, speaking to us today from public radio station WVAS there in Montgomery. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. The scholar Kirk Kernet is joining us. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Jeff in Salt Lake. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I just wanted to share my connection to the Fitzgerald family. I packed away a watercolor map that was given to me by Waverly Barber, professor of library science at the University of Alabama when I was an undergraduate. And his best friend in life had been Scotty Fitzgerald, F. Scott and Zelda's daughter. And so Waverly and I would sit, and of course I, like most Alabama teenagers, had read it in high school, but we revisited the literature while Waverly and I drank copious amounts of scotch, and he regaled me with stories of Scotty Fitzgerald and her, sort of experience of being the daughter of these two very famous people. So Waverly had given Scotty this watercolor map of France, and Scotty said, "Make sure Waverly gets his map back," and reflected as much in her will. And so in Waverly's will, he said, "Make sure Jess gets Scotty's map." So today I'm packing up that watercolor map, and I'm shipping all of it back to Alabama. I'm going back to Alabama for a brief visit and leaving the antiques there and moving to New York City, like other writers, to make my way there.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
First, let me say Roll Tide, and then, Scotty Fitzgerald spent the last 5 years of her life in Montgomery, and there are many, many people here who remember her fondly because of that sort of generosity and tolerance that Jeff's talking about. She didn't particularly enjoy people bringing up her parents to her, as I understand it. But if the subject came up, she was more than willing to entertain it. And I think the story that I like the most about her, and it's related in a way, is as she was dying of cancer, she would invite people to come over to her house and help themselves to her library. And a friend of mine who's a sales manager for Unbridled Books has talked to me about how bizarre it was to actually go there, and very tentatively you felt like you were robbing a museum taking a book from Scotty Fitzgerald. But he does have a few of them, and he says he'll never get rid of them.
This does go, I feel a little torn in some ways. On one hand, thinking of Daisy as not this fully formed character, as kind of the symbol. But then on the other hand, I think of the relationship with F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda.
Mm-hmm.
Zelda, of course, had engaged in this affair with this French aviator, which had caused this deep damage to their relationship. And this idea that, and I keep seeing this too, this concept that Gatsby, that the real tragedy of the book in some way was that Gatsby had fallen for the wrong girl, this kind of vacuous girl, but that but that there was this idea of loyalty and love. So in some ways, that's also very relevant. And I keep seeing F. Scott Fitzgerald in there and a kind of sense of resentment or maybe guilt for it all.
Well, I do think that that's inevitable. And I think we as male readers kind of need to resist the blaming the woman sort of approach.
Yeah.
You know, Daisy is corrupt. And she chooses or is coerced to choose not to admit her own guilt in things that happen in the book. But that passivity is, well, it's hers personally. It's also something culturally instilled in her. And she was not a person who was ever raised to be self-sufficient. And I think it's probably not there in the book, but I want to see, where I want to believe that she was wise enough to know that Gatsby was as much in love with an image of her as with the real her, whoever she might be, mm-hmm. when she grew up. You know, the classic moment that's not in the movie is when Gatsby is invited over to the Buchanans, and he's confronted for the first time with Daisy's daughter. And, you know, the way Fitzgerald describes it, you can almost see, I mean, it's classic single dude sort of reaction. Oh, my God, you got kids?
Yeah.
I hate to say it that way, but it's true. And you lose some sympathy for Gatsby at that moment. But I think it's in there for a reason. And it's meant to say that, you know, that Gatsby's naivete, you know, is sort of the counterbalance to Daisy's awareness that, you know, she can't just run off with another man.
Yeah. There's a section in the, I want to come around to a section that you pointed out to us, which you say is one of the most autobiographical passages in the book. This section where Nick has decided to leave the East Coast and he's moving back to the Midwest. And it's this idea of, you know, returning to your roots. And you talk about how Fitzgerald, you know, he went to school in New Jersey, and this is a kind of broader recollection of this idea of him coming home.
Mm-hmm. It's another one of my favorite passages. And, you know, the thing I love about the book is there are passages in it that have no real plot importance. They're just we drift off into reflective moments where we meditate on a certain memory or a certain image. And to me, this is Fitzgerald thinking of all of the winters that he would ride the train back. And it builds up to this sort of discussion of what it means to be a Middle West, from the Middle West, and how much less glamorous it is to be from there than to be a New Yorker. And it's right after that he gives the famous line that, you know, this has been a story of the Middle West as opposed to the East. So it's a great passage.
One of my most vivid memories is of coming back west from prep school and later from college at Christmas time. Those who went farther than Chicago would gather in the old dim Union Station at 6 o'clock of a December evening with a few Chicago friends already caught up into their own holiday gaieties to bid them a hasty goodbye. I remember the fur coats of the girls returning from Miss This or That's, and the chatter of frozen breath, and the hands waving overhead as we caught sight of old acquaintances, and the matchings of invitations. Are you going to the Ordways? The Hersheys? The Schultzes? And the long green tickets clasped tight in our gloved hands. And last, the murky yellow cars of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad, looking cheerful as Christmas itself on the tracks beside the gate. When we pulled out into the winter night, and the real snow, our snow, began to stretch out beside us and twinkle against the windows, and the dim lights of small Wisconsin stations moved by, a sharp wild brace came suddenly into the air. We drew in deep breaths of it as we walked back from dinner, through the cold vestibules, unutterably aware of our identity with this country for one strange hour, before we melted indistinguishably into it again. That's my Middle West. Not the wheat, or the prairies, or the lost Swede towns, but the thrilling returning trains of my youth, and the street lamps and sleigh bells in the frosty dark, and the shadows of holly wreaths thrown by lighted windows on the snow. I am part of that, a little solemn with the feel of those long winters, a little complacent from growing up in the Caraway house, in a city where dwellings are still called through decades by a family's name. I see now that this has been a story of the West. After all, Tom and Gatsby, Daisy and Jordan and I, were all Westerners, and perhaps we possess some deficiency in common which made us subtly unadaptable to Eastern life.
Let me ask you this finally, Kirk Krennert. I've got about a minute left. So, it seems remarkable that this book almost kind of disappeared completely. Somehow was reclaimed from obscurity in the 1940s. Aren't you glad it did? It made it back?
Yeah, it's nice to have a career. It's like a lot of literature, it needed time to sort of to come into its own and to be discovered. And, of course, the biographical legend is part of the poignancy of reading the book as well. But, you know, word for word, it's hard to think of a novel that strikes this tone between the charm of the language and the sentimentality of the emotion and does it in a way that has that sort of depth of meaning and theme that we ask of literature.
That's Kirk Krennert, Vice President of the International F. Scott Fitzgerald Society, joined us from Montgomery. Kirk Krennert, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.